I had this revelation. If everyone likes you, no one likes you. So there are going to be people that you don't resonate with. But then I also thought, like, how can I be the most effective and potent in this world? Because I think we all have a responsibility to a certain extent to position ourselves that way. And I thought, well, it's not going to be with a shirt and tie, because I tried that. I did punch a clock. I did tuck my shirt in, and it wasn't honest to me. And because I was going through a rebirth and I didn't have anything, I had nothing to lose. So it didn't take a lot of courage for me. What it took is, okay, I'm making a promise to myself. I'm now, from here on out, I'm going to make decisions that feel honest to me and that to change. And I'm going to do my best to live a life where this is who I am.
All right. Today's podcast is with my friend, John Kim. John, otherwise known as the Angry Therapist. John is a repeat guest on the podcast, but he was recently in town, led a great event at Gravity. Hopefully you were there. If you were not, I'm sorry you missed it, because John is a special person. It was really an honor to have him here in our community of Columbus, in the Gravity community. And it was great to have him back on the podcast. We had an awesome conversation, sort of weaves around, but really gets current with John and what he's up to now. And yeah, if you don't know John, he's a licensed therapist, speaker, and author of the bestseller, I Used to Be a Miserable Fuck, and Single on Purpose. He is a writer for Psychology Today, among many other publications, and has been featured in the New York Post, NPR, Armchair Expert, Vice, and currently is a television show in development at ABC based on his life. John changed the temperature of therapy 12 years ago after going through a divorce. He started a blog called The Angry Therapist and quickly built a devoted following of fans who love the frank and authentic insights that he freely shares on social media. He's pulled the curtain back on himself by practicing transparency and sharing his story, something that therapists are really taught not to do. This is the thing I love about John, is he's, you know, doing things unconventionally. He works outside the box. He's meeting clients at coffee shops and on hikes and in gyms. And as he says, he comes to you instead of at you. It's casual over clinical. These are his words, and I just love them. He lives in California now and raising his daughter with his girlfriend. He's still writing books and sending texts and riding motorcycles and helping people rewrite their stories. And yeah, John's just one of the guys that I really respect and relate to, that's doing things in a way that I certainly lands with me, that I get a lot out of. And hopefully you do too. Enjoy. Yeah, so I started to write it because I just felt like a sort of calling to doing it.
Yeah.
And it's been an interesting journey. I mean, you said you're on six?
I'm on six if you include the workbook. You know, the thing about a workbook is it's kind of, I don't even know if you could say this these days, but the redheaded stepchild that you know what I'm talking about. It's like,
sure.
It's like the you have your books.
Yeah.
And then if a book is popular, then your publishers will say, you know, let's make a workbook.
Yeah.
Let's make, you know, playing cards.
Yeah.
Let's make a calendar. Like, let's, you know.
Right.
And I thought, you know, a workbook would actually be cool. And I've never done a workbook, and I want to do it. And I want it to be kind of small, people can carry around. And I also like the idea of doing some kind of program. So I said, it's based off Single on Purpose. So I said, the workbook is 30 days of being single on purpose. Mm-hmm. And so each day is like an exercise and stuff. But now when I think about books, there's a part of me that's like, oh, that's just a workbook. Like, dismissive of that. And so sometimes I say, is it five books or is it six books? Mm-hmm. If I include the workbook, then it's six. Mm-hmm.
I say six.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we don't do it with our children, so we can't, you know. I mean, friends, yeah. Well, I don't really like this friend, but, you know.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, I've never done it, so I can't really speak to, you know, what it feels like. But it seems like
it's an extension of a book. That's what.
Yeah, and you're like, you're definitely like, creating a book,
yeah,
putting it in the world. But yeah, they're just numbers, I guess. You know, for me, it was about kind of sort of what we, and I still have to kind of move through this as it moves forward, you know, the solid self thing.
Yeah.
It just felt like, you know, this is something that I want to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, I want to do things like that I want to do. I don't want to let fear,
right,
you know, right, and worry and judgment. Oh, you know, everybody tells you the horror stories about publishers, yep, and you can't make any money, and you know, and it's crowded, and that's fine. So what I decided to do was to write a book that was cathartic for me to write and that I thought would be something that maybe my kids would like to read.
Oh, that's great.
You know, that sort of like in the spirit of like the last lecture, you know, like I want to just sort of give them the full story of dad that maybe they wouldn't know because we don't sit down and like talk about it like at that level for that long, you know?
Also your internal journey, right? So what a great idea. Also, what a great gift. I was thinking, so my dad has passed, but I was thinking, I didn't know my dad well because I don't speak Korean well. He doesn't speak English well, right? Mm-hmm. So our conversations can't go. It's basically, how are you? Are you doing well? What do you want for lunch? I mean, we're not talking about, you know, deeper things, right? Mm-hmm. And so if he had a book that he wrote for me, because you could translate languages, so he could write in Korean, and that had to do with his inner journey, his insecurities, his demons, him slaying dragons. And then once he passed that, or even if he didn't pass, that book would be so valuable to me because it's a conduit directly into my dad's inner journey. And so for you to write that for your children, that's amazing. And also what you're doing is really cool because there's a purity to it as opposed to going through, you know, the publishing and where there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen and then they'll try to, you know, change title. I mean, they'll try to market it or angle it in a way that may not be honest to you, right? Mm-hmm. So you're making your own movie. You're going on your own ride. Mm-hmm. And I think you're writing this for yourself, which is not a lot of people have that privilege.
And, you know, back to your question, I think, well, you know, this is sort of something I've kind of started to adopt in pretty much everything that I do, which is, that if I feel like it would be something I would like to have in the world or would have liked to have had, you know, from a, you know, when my dad passed in November, and it wasn't really until he got sick and we started to like realize the finality of it that I started to feel this urgency to really know him and to really ask him like, what happened and tell me about that. What was that like?
Were you guys close?
Well, we worked for many, many years and we gained a closeness, you know, at the end. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was through the knowing, getting to know and to really understand. And when you start to really understand somebody, it creates a closeness. And so, you know, I think that if I create something that's aimed at my kids, it'll be something that will appeal to a lot of kids, to a lot of people, to a lot of young men, to a lot of people that are on a journey, right? And so the book is really about not me so much. It's really about a path towards creating, you know, I was just talking about this, you know, with Brandon, you know, it's about how do we use our entire lives?
Yeah, your story.
As information to serve you so that you can heal and create from that place, ultimately in service of other people. And so if my story and how that's unfolded for me is something that other people can take something away from, then, you know, hopefully it has, you know, some broader appeal too.
I mean, this is what we were talking about last night, where I was saying that there's a tipping point where your story becomes greater than you. And so, yeah, I mean, you have an amazing story. If that is put on paper and you tell it in a way that's honest and everything that you have struggled with and all your failures and triumphs and all that, that's how we learn.
Yeah.
So it's not so much you saying, this is how to live your life. It's you saying, here's how I lived my life. Here's what I struggled with. Here are also some tips. Here are some successes. Mm-hmm. And I think we've always learned, even when, you know, in the caveman days, when we were drawing things on the walls, it's always been through a story that we learn, not through just someone behind a podium, you know? And so I love the memoir hybrid, you know, self-betterment. Mm-hmm. And of course, you've learned a lot of things on the way. So
yeah,
that's awesome. I'm excited for you. And I also want to say, we had one conversation, I think, on the phone, and this was about, what, 3-4 years? How many years ago was this?
Probably back that far.
And this is when you first found me.
Yeah.
You weren't doing any of this.
Yeah.
Because one of the things we were talking about was, I mean, you were doing, obviously, your day job, the development and all that. And I think you were curious about things. And you're like, actually, I want to write a book.
Yeah.
I want to do some social media stuff. I think we mentioned the podcast, but even then you didn't really know. And you're kind of curious. Here we are today. Mm-hmm. You're about 200 episodes in, you said, podcast.
Yeah.
You're like, what, 70, 80% done with a book?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, dude, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And I don't know how it feels for you. If it feels like you've actually are doing what we talked about, or if you feel like you're still on the outside trying to do stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's a good question. And both is the answer. You know, we talked about this a little bit last night, you know, and I had one guest, an artist that did a beautiful mural here.
Yeah.
You know, say that you can't be like a part-time artist and expect to be good at it, right? And you brought this up last night, like
the reps.
Yeah, you got to get a lot of reps, right? I've struggled to do like solo stuff because that takes reps. You know, you're right. Really good at doing that. That's what you do.
I don't have a day job like you. I don't.
Well, so
that building shit.
Yeah. So that's the thing, you know. But the thing that keeps me going and what got me to continue to move forward with these projects is, you know, what you were talking about last night, this solid self.
Yeah.
It feels to me like something that is a part of my path, a part of who I am at that solid level.
Yeah.
And it always has, you know, even as a little kid, and I've just, you know, kind of talked about this ad nauseum, but like I went to therapy when I was 8 years old. Mm. I loved it. I started digesting Wayne Dyer books on tape in middle school. Shit. And I loved
it. Are you
it.
Serious?
Yeah. Middle school? I've always gravitated to this kind of work, to connecting with people.
Yeah.
As I've started to do it, speaking publicly, sharing vulnerably, you see how it makes a difference in people's lives. That gives you energy. It gives you a lot of, you know, desire to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I got a day job. And so there's only so many hours in the day. And, you know, I'd say for that reason, I still feel very much like I don't really know yet where it's going and how it continues to unfold.
And that's the other thing. I think a lot of people are searching for what that's going to look like, me included. And I think if you don't make it your business, but you continue to show up in an authentic way and pull from your solid self. And look, we all have bills to pay. We all have, you know, not everyone has the luxury to just do what their, you know, their loved art, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you keep feeding, I think that that's all itself. It's limitless what can come out of that. And usually it's something you didn't even imagine.
Yeah.
But you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of stuff that I mean, I didn't know I was going to have a 4-year-old child. You know, I didn't think I was going to have children at all. There are things that happen in life that if you don't be consumed with tracing a blueprint can be like, holy shit.
Look, yeah.
What is this? How did this happen?
And yeah.
But it's because I was just following my bliss and my truth and standing on it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I want to talk about that. It's kind of what I was thinking we would talk about today. I want to just circle back because I'm selfishly curious because you asked me a question about why I wrote the book or why I'm writing the book.
Yeah.
And I think your question was really like, why did you write the whole book? And so.
Do you have a title yet or no?
No.
Oh, yeah.
Although I have one in my mind, I just haven't like landed on it.
Yeah.
And what happened was, you know, I have a lot of friends that are in that world, especially in the self-publishing world.
Yeah.
I happen to be friends with three that are self-publishers.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them introduced me to a very well-known, successful author who I really admired, who wrote a wonderful book that I loved, and I got a call with her and sent her, you know, it wasn't really a proposal, but it was sort of like a light proposal.
Right. Here's my idea.
Sample chapter kind of thing, which is what I was told, you know, you're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And she read it and basically came back and said, yeah, no.
No, as in like, it's not going to work? No, as in what's...
There was a lot of no's. It was like one, which is pretty disheartening, but maybe just facts, which is like, you don't have a following.
Yeah.
And no publisher is going to look at you because that's what it's about.
Right.
Like they might take one project a year where they put money into it. Otherwise, if you don't have a following, they're not going to touch you.
Mm.
So that was sort of disheartening, but it was like less about the work.
Right.
And then, you know, the other feedback is like, yeah, it's sort of like a therapeutic book for yourself, but, you know, not sure that has a wide appeal.
Sure.
Might be true. I don't know. So that's what I'm like, well, screw it. Then I'm just going to write it in full and write it for my kids. And then, you know, I don't really care what happens with it. If somebody likes it and wants to do something with it, great.
if I end up just, you know, handing it out to people and, you know, leaving it around town, that's fine.
Question, did that author know like the in-person communities you're building and these projects as far as the buildings?
Not really.
Because I feel like that, to me, that's a huge part of you.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know this. I feel like that gives you so much cred as far as he's done something in this world. There are people living in his buildings and their lives are changed because he's having workshops. Like that to me is everything. So if you don't have a following, well, then what is your story? Where have you gone and come back? What have you built? And you've done a lot there. So if you take that piece out, I could see her just judging the idea. Mm-hmm. But a lot of books get published and bought, not just because of the idea, but the story of the person or what they've done. And there are people that have sold books with very little following.
Yeah.
Because of other reasons. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So if you take that out, I could see just her like judging what's on the page.
Yeah. Which is probably what happened because, you know, in fairness to her, she was kind of doing a favor for a friend and probably didn't take the time. Yeah. And you know, also this is back a few years where a lot of the stuff hadn't been built yet.
Right, right.
But yeah, I mean, I guess I was going to just ask you your thoughts on kind of the publishing world and, you know, the routes that people go. You know, it seems like, you know, we talked a little bit about just how many podcasts there are. Everybody's got a book. Yeah. Everybody's got a podcast. Yeah. It's pretty saturated.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on just kind of that world?
Yeah. I mean, I come from the screenwriting world where it's feast or famine, where the chances of you going to film school, majored in screenwriting, and I wrote every day for like 10 hours a day, had no life. The chances of a script getting bought was like winning the lottery, right? And so rejection was every day. Or you would spend 3 months with this idea, you write a screenplay, and your manager or agent doesn't even say yes. So it doesn't even leave the fucking house, you know? Mm. And then you're like, okay, so now I have to go back and write something else. The book business is like that, where it's hard to get in. If you can't prove that you can sell a lot of books, they're not going to, because they're going to give you an advance. They're going to cut trees down. They're going to have teams design the cover. Like, it's like a movie, right? There's it goes through a lot of departments for the book to be held in your hand. And so for that to actually make them money, because it is a business, you have to prove to them you're going to sell a lot of these, right? Or it's going to, you know, be different or significant. And for a first-time author, that's really hard to do. So for me, I didn't even have an agent. And I heard an agent on a podcast, and she said, I, in my 20, 30 years of being an agent, and because I was listening to it, I was like, oh, that's the kind of agent I want. She was like this New York hustler, been around forever. And she said, don't, because the host said, how can they get hold of you if anyone wants to, you know, submit something? She's like, don't, I get, you know, thousands of query letters. I could count in the 34 years I've been doing this, on one hand, how many clients I've taken on, right? Mm-hmm. Well, I emailed her with zero expectation. Mm-hmm. Here I am, blah, blah, blah. This is, I want to write a book about men. It's a good time, blah, blah, blah. It was called 68. And it was 68 things that I think men should look at or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And she responded back. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it was I was a minority and I was not your conventional therapist. So I think that's what kind of grabbed her. Mm-hmm. Oh, here's this kind of Korean guy on a Harley talking about men. And then she's like, I think we could sell this. And we went out with it. We went to like 20 people. Everyone said no. And it was like flash dance. Me going, it was exciting. Me going into, you know, because the publishing world is in New York. So me going into big rooms with, by flash dance, I know I'm dating myself, but it's like all the people.
And we're the same age.
Oh, yeah. So, right. You get it.
I love your references.
Yes.
You were doing it all last night. And I'm like, I wonder if anyone else knows these references.
I used in one of my books recently. I put the word etch-a-sketch, Shake Your Life etch-a-sketch, and it came back, it crossed out like, what the fuck is an etch-a-sketch? I was like, oh, okay. Anyway, so I did my rounds in New York and you pitch in person from, you know, these people and you get a lot of, you know, oh, we love you, praise, but then they pass. So rejection. And the last meeting was on Zoom and it was only like 20 minutes. And I was like, of course, they're going to reject it as well, but it's HarperCollins, they're big, let's meet with them anyway, met with them. And she ended up buying the book. Mm. And then she's like, let's not call it 68. What else should we call it? And she's like, you know, in your story, you talk about being a miserable fuck. What if it's, I used to be a miserable fuck? It's a sentence in your proposal. And I was like, oh. And then I was like, I don't want to get on the fuck train because the subtle art of not giving a fuck was huge. It's all these, you know, fuck books and fuck yourself. Mm-hmm. And she's like, no, it's used differently. And I think like for this one, if Johnny Cash wrote a book, self-help book, what would that look like? And when she said that, something clicked.
Mm.
And so I listened to Man Comes Around from Johnny Cash. I love that. I listened to that song.
I have it on like redo.
Dude, that song gives me chills.
I know.
Walking in New York City, coming out of the office, just selling that.
Yeah.
And she said, what if Johnny Cash wrote a self-help book? And I listened to that song on repeat. And I swear, dude, I was walking and I felt the energy. Like I could walk through a wall.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then I was going to call it Man Comes Around.
Yeah.
Like you can't, I don't, music title, whatever.
Yeah, it is. Right.
But like, that's what I really wanted to call it.
Yeah.
But it ended up being, I used to be a miserable fuck.
Yeah.
And that's how we met.
Yeah.
So an email.
Yeah.
Yeah. To someone who said, don't email me.
Right.
Led to pitches.
Yeah.
All these no's, one yes.
Yeah.
Led to a book, which your therapist
husband
read.
Yeah.
And that's how we met.
Yeah.
Which led to me doing a little workshop for your community.
Like yeah. Yeah. And you know, I started to talk about this with you last night. Like I met somebody who then introduced me to Josh. And now I introduced you to Josh because we met. And you know, it's like a one email.
Yeah.
I think what I'm like feeling in.
Well, I was going to say I think it's not just a new email. It's the solid self.
Yes.
It's that hope, that belief. It's that what if. It's like. So the reason I emailed her was because I was at a point in my life where I felt like a screenwriter.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend said, why don't you just query and try to write self-help books? You're a therapist. I was like, yeah, fuck writing. I hate writing. I'm never going to make it as a writer. And then it was the solid self.
Mm-hmm.
It was the part of me that I locked away when I didn't make it as a screenwriter that I said I'm going to reunite with. And I started blogging and I was like, you know what? What if I sent this? So, so it wasn't just an email. It was an email that was lined with pulling from a solid part of me.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot I'm wanting to talk about with you, but I think I asked you a question last night about like expansion, right? Because I've been organizing the way I'm thinking about this in the book, you know, awaken, align, expand.
Yeah, which I love.
And the Johnny Cash thing could take me on a whole of a rabbit hole by itself because there's a lot there. I love Johnny Cash. But, you know, your answer to me on expansion was really good. It kind of brings me back to this solid self and it brings me back to this email and even the question about the book. What I'm kind of feeling is like when you trust the solid self and, you know, I had my late therapist who was a really powerful influence in my life. He used to call them these flashes of insight.
Mm.
You know, it's like a flash, a feeling, right? And when you trust that and you go with it and then you do it over a long period of time because I think I think it requires patience.
Sure.
It's not always like an immediate dot connection, right? I mean, this is years in the making before you come here, before whatever happens with Josh happens, before whatever else happens, right?
Yeah.
And that was sort of your answer is like, I don't know, right? But like you just keep trusting that over and over again.
Like, and like planting seeds.
And the expansion then just sort of like in a way that like I'm sort of in awe of happens.
Yeah. And you know, I think I'm older than you, but you know, one of the things as what Carl Jung talks about is the afternoon of your life, me turning 50 now, right? Also being
Are you 50?
I'm 50.
Yeah, I'm be 49 next month.
Okay, so, just, so yeah, a little bit older than
behind you. Yeah.
I'm actually going to be 51. Fuck. I'm going to be 51 in a month. But there's something about the afternoon of my life where I'm just able to surrender more, you know, because in my 20s and 30s, I would grip. This is what I'm going to be making at this age. This is what I'm going to be driving. This is who I'm going to be. You know, lots of shoulds, a very loud ticking clock, lots of posturing, lots of aggression, and lots of, you know,
urgency. Yeah.
And also this very big ego and also driven to prove myself and a lot of stuff coming from pseudo, right? So the exchanging truth for membership kind of thing. And then also, you know, grew up in LA. So now to actually surrender and trust that how the expansion is going to manifest and expansion, you know, we're talking right now about career and stuff, but it could also be expansion in relationships.
Mm-hmm.
It could also be trusting that there's going to be expansion with you and I and being okay with not knowing what that looks like, you know, or expansion in your friendships or your partner or your kids. I think that's where life nectar and beauty is,
yeah.
is the not knowing, but trusting by showing up honestly and then being it, standing in front of that painting and being like, holy shit, look at this work of art.
Yeah.
Which I never even, because it's not colored by numbers.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I just trusted this and then this is what unfolded.
Mm-hmm.
I just love the idea of seeing life that way.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And I do think that takes time to settle into.
You got to be patient, man.
Yeah.
I struggle with.
Well, not only the patience, but I think like you got to go through your 20s and 30s and you got to got to like work that shit out so that you can like land in a spot where you get that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know any, I mean, unless you're maybe like a monk or you, you know,
right.
You got to go through experimentation. You got to go through, like you said, awakening before you hit alignment, before you hit expansion. I mean, it's like, you know, belts in jujitsu. I think you have to start, everyone starts with a white belt, you know, and it's messy.
Let's back up a little bit. You know, you've shared your story. You were on the podcast before, you know, I think people know your journey, but, you know, maybe you want to just talk a little bit about kind of how you moved through those stages. What I'm kind of wanting to hear more about is, you know, you talked about like break dancing.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you know, last night you were talking about not being academically inclined, right? Like daydreamer. Right. I very much relate to that. Like, even
did you get good grades or
no?
Yeah.
Terrible. Oh, yeah, daydreamer, terrible. Not interested at all. But like, I recall, and I was a little more cautious about living into solid self, but I can remember like what it felt like to get on a skateboard.
Yeah.
Right. And to be with like my skater friends and not my athlete friends.
Right.
Right. To go into the art room and like see there's solid self, but I was scared to live into it.
Mm-hmm.
Scared of judgment, you know, those things. And yet, you know, like I see how you've taken that and applied it to therapy.
Yeah.
Right.
There's also this piece, I don't know if it's healthy. My dad was an alcoholic. My mom's dad was an alcoholic. There's definitely an addiction in the family. When I get into things, I get obsessive. So I don't know if it's a gift or a curse.
Mm.
So whether it's skating. So like when I used to skate, I mean, I would lie in bed just going over the moves to practice the next day. When I was breakdancing, I would spend hours by myself, you know, spinning on my head or doing, you know, when I was playing with Legos at age 8, I would lock myself in a room and forget to eat. So there's this like obsessive, you know, the whole like artist cutting his ear off kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I started to write books and then, you know, podcast, social media, I think the reason why I think produce a lot is because I get obsessed, you know, and I think that could be solid self, but I think that could also be unhealthy.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like, are you doing it to numb? Are you doing it because it is truth and it's where you find flow? I don't know. You know,
well, how do you answer that for yourself as you think about yourself now and the things that you do, you know, that might be obsessive?
Well, going back to the whole reps thing, I don't know if you can be great. I think you could be good. I don't know if you can be great in anything you do on this planet unless there's that component to it.
Yeah.
I don't think you have to lose your life. But when you hear about like, you know, whether it's Jordan or Tiger Woods or other people who are goats, who are great, I mean, the amount of obsession, I mean, starting at age 3 or, you know, whatever it is after practice, you know, shooting another 1,000, like any athlete. And I think also artists, musicians, some people just have natural gifts and, you know, but man, I think it's one of the ingredients that's required to be really exceptional or to stand out, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. And I think it kind of begs another question. I've actually been working on doing a solo episode on balance because I think that people get confused around that subject.
Yeah.
And that, you know, they want to have everything perfectly parsed out where they spend, you know, a certain amount of time at work, certain
Right. The whole life, work-life balance thing.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, is a myth.
It is.
Yeah.
I think so because what I've kind of tried to live is don't go too far in one direction for too long. Mm-hmm. It's the length of time that you're there.
Yeah.
Like you can be great at something, but you're then something else is going to give. And so, you know, stay over there, get really good at it. I don't know if you can be great, but you can't like ignore your family either.
Gotta come back.
Right?
Gotta come back.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's what separates artists who don't come back. And then it becomes, you know, whether they fall into a depression or they ruin, you know, families, relationships. It's artists that kind of get to the edge. So, you know, 6 months working on a movie, 3 months working on a book, you know, a year to build a building, whatever it is, getting kind of obsessed. And then, of course, coming back. So, I, you know, with work-life balance, for me, it's kind of project to project and there's an ebb and flow to it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't believe that there's a pie, a life pie that you cut up that's going to be equal and you have to follow that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting thing, the whole like obsession and as it pertains to work. And I'm kind of curious to hear, you know, you're a dad now.
Yeah.
4-year-old.
Yeah.
And, you know, oftentimes, you know, as I've been kind of moving into this like second half of life, you know, and really I've been sort of grappling with this for a while now, probably about 10 years. Chip Conley actually talks a lot about like the age frame in which men and women go through this, you know, he calls it a chrysalis.
Yeah.
Where I used to think it was like 50 and beyond. It started for me around 40. And apparently, you know, that's like also pretty normal.
Wait, are you talking about what the world calls a quote unquote midlife crisis?
Yes.
Is that what like?
Yeah. He calls it a chrysalis.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Right.
Which I like, because I'm like, I'm going through a midlife crisis is what people call it. It doesn't feel like a crisis to me at all.
It's more awesome. Awakening. Yeah, yeah, you're right. You know, yeah. Also, crisis is that's labeled, it's loaded, and it means that you're, it's a negative, negative connotation.
Yeah. But, you know, as you start to look at yourself and your life, you start to evaluate, well, what matters?
Yeah.
You know, and you know, you can kind of look back and you know, people talk about, there's very few people in the history that like generations are still talking about. You know, when you think about like your great grandparents, you know, well, how much are you talking about them? Mm-hmm. You know, how much are your kids going to know them? Mm-hmm. You know? And so when I think about like work, you know, I think about, well, I want to do things. Like last night when people come up to you and they say like, this is making a difference in my life.
Yeah.
Well, that feels like it matters,
yeah.
But I'm not sure like how much really matters in the work world when I think of it like relative to my kids,
right,
to my family, like right. That feels like that really matters. So I don't know. I'm just kind of curious, you know, when you think about the obsession, when you think about pouring yourself into work, you do work that does matter. It's making a difference in people's lives. You know, is that what allows you? Well,
yeah, I think obviously becoming a dad, and you're a dad way before me. I don't think anything changes your life overnight faster than becoming a parent. So now all your decisions, I mean, you know, once you become a parent, literally holding the baby in your hand, everything is now going to be different, at least to a certain extent, right? Mm-hmm. The choices and decisions you make, where you spend time. So it's that kind of figuring out how much of my time is for me to hone my gifts and share with the world. How much of my time is for my partner, for my friends? How much of my time is for my children? And yeah, I mean, I don't think it's realistic that it's going to be consistent. I think you're going to sacrifice things, you know? So for me, it's like, what's the thing that I can allow myself to be a little obsessive about because I see potential in this and I see it me planting a seed that's going to grow something bigger than me and that's worth the investment. And then I go do that, but I make sure that I come back, like you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm okay with that. I think that's how I want to live my life. I don't see myself denying. Here's a good example, my motorcycle, okay? A lot of people can say, you're dad now, sell your bike.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're 50, dude. And right now, it's honest to me, it brings me joy. And I think Carl Jung has some kind of, I'm paraphrasing, but basically, the worst thing you can do for your children is to not live.
Yeah,
you know?
That's the on life live. Yeah.
And I love that because I see so many parents who have sacrificed their lives for their children.
Yeah.
And so they put down the brush or sell the bike or do whatever. And now they're unhappy and hollow.
Mm-hmm.
And they think they're being a good parent because they sacrificed this for their kids. But what kind of example are they setting? You know? And so
that quote is the reason I started my company, because I had spent 15 years, you know, working for others and wasn't very energized about my work.
Yeah.
And I had a job that was separate from my life. And I started.
That was a punching a clock kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I call it punching a clock as opposed to punching the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And punching a clock is the pseudo punching the sky. So that's when you started Gravity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. I first started Kauffman Development, which, you know, led me to Gravity. But that, I think, is really a big one.
Yeah.
You know, I think that people, you know, back to my point about like what really matters, showing your kids how you live, right?
Yeah.
Not telling them.
Yeah.
Including the bike. You know, I think there's something to be said there too, that like, you know, for your kids to see you joyful.
Yes.
Peaceful.
Yes. It's not
free.
It's not just a bike. It's what it represents.
Yeah.
Right. So
yeah,
Vanessa and I, once in a while, we will go on a motorcycle ride. And there's a part of me that's like, fuck, we're parents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of us can go on it, but should we both be on it?
Mm-hmm.
What if we both go down?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's this like, it's almost like, are we being responsible parents if we're both, you know, and we do it.
Yeah.
And then I thought to myself, okay, if I was seven and I saw my parents get on a fucking motorcycle, hire a babysitter for me, go down the driveway and go and do their thing for a couple hours,
mm-hmm.
I would be like, they would be superheroes to me.
Yeah.
I wouldn't see them as, oh, they're selfish.
Mm-hmm.
I would be like, that's what I want to do when I grow up.
Yeah.
I want to put someone on my bike and ride and go have an adventure and go be Ferris Bueller for, that's not that bad. Ferris Bueller's doesn't age me that much, but like, you know, for one day.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well,
set the example.
And I wonder, you know, if we might not even know what our kids will think. They might see it that way.
They might see it
another way.
Right?
Fuck off.
Right.
But like, you know, you can't spend your whole life worrying about that either.
Well, you know, it doesn't matter what they will see. They will know that it was at least my truth.
Yeah.
So they could disagree.
Yes.
But at least they'll know that, hey, you know what? My dad stood on his street. He lived his life.
Yeah.
He did his thing.
Yeah.
And I don't agree with it. I wouldn't do it. But I kind of admire the fact that he had the courage to do that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think courage brings me back to this, you know, authentic self, the casual over clinical.
Yes.
That's your language.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. You know, we were talking about the academics, right? And I listen to you read your writing, and it's beautiful. It's technically, it sounds like a very well-written, intelligent.
Oh, thanks.
And you, but you've learned a lot.
Yeah.
You're knowledgeable. You know, I see you as smart. And yet, like, I think there's this thing, you know, that you've probably had to wrestle with, I'm curious about, just like societal norms.
Yeah.
Right. That, you know, therapists are supposed to be X,
right,
and, you know, your credentials matter. And if you're a coach and not a therapist, and, you know, when you can't ride bikes, you can't, you know, meet people in coffee shops. And even still, you know, how you continue to approach the work that you're doing, it's very you. And people like that. That's sort of the secret sauce. And so, but yet, like, it takes some courage to do that when the societal norm or whoever else is saying, that's not how it's done.
Yeah. It takes more courage when you have things to lose. And one of the things that I had was nothing to lose. So I needed less courage. So after my divorce, you know, because I had nothing, the courage to pull from my solid self was much easier for me. Because I didn't have friends. I didn't have pushback. I didn't have a built-in structure. I was free to just be me. No one was watching. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing with an audience today with social media. If I didn't have the runway of being transparent on Tumblr, where I was posting about feelings and my inner journey for 5 years and, you know, 5,000 blog posts, if I didn't have that runway, would I still be tanning my taint on Instagram and being doing things that, you know, are very me? I don't know, because I would be too scared. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it took me being comfortable with myself, which is a journey, and not giving myself a choice and saying, hey, listen, this is who I am and not everyone's going to like it. And then I thought, you know what? If everyone likes it, no one likes it.
Mm-hmm.
I had this revelation. If everyone likes you, no one likes you.
Yeah.
So there are going to be people that you don't resonate with. There are going to be people that don't want you to meet them at the coffee shop, walk around the lake. There's going to be people that want to sit on a couch. You're not that guy. You may not be for that person, right? But then I also thought, like, how can I be the most effective and potent in this world? Because I think we all have a responsibility to a certain extent to position ourselves that way, right? And I thought, well, it's not going to be with a shirt and tie, because I tried that. You know, it's not like I just went crazy. I tried that.
Yeah.
I got jobs, high-end residential treatment centers on Malibu to eating disorder clinics in Pasadena, 5 years nonprofit. I did punch a clock. I did tuck my shirt in. And I did use the generic interventions at the in the filing cabinet. I did all that. And it wasn't honest to me. And I felt probably like how you felt before Kauffman development and gravity, fraudulent. I felt kind of gross. I felt like this is not sustainable, you know? And because I was going through a rebirth and I didn't have anything, I had nothing to lose. So it didn't take a lot of courage for me. What it took is, okay, I'm making a promise to myself. And I remember this. I said, here's my promise to myself. I don't care if you cut my arm off. I don't care if I die. I'm now, from here on out, I'm going to make decisions that feel honest to me, you know? And that could change. And I'm going to do my best to live a life where this is who I am.
Yeah.
Giving myself courage. So I made that promise when I had nothing. Could I make that promise today? It would be much harder. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah.
Because now I have a little community. I've got a following. I've got pressure. I've got a kid. I've got friends. I've got a life. And so there's more at risk if I try to make a promise like that today, where people may not like me if I show a side of me that that's not on.
Yeah, I tend to think you'd do it anyway if, because I just, you know, in my experience, I was married. I had three kids. I had friends. I had a house.
At 40? Boy,
well, at 35, 36 when I started my company.
Okay.
You know, I was doing all those things.
Yeah.
But, you know, my coach at the time said, people make a jump, you know, like I made, for one of two reasons. Either you're drowning where you are, you're a miserable fuck, or you're on fire, excited about something you want to do. And I was both. I was really not happy doing what I was doing. It felt pseudo self, you know, really.
You were successful on paper, it seemed like.
I was.
Early, yeah.
I was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I had a really cushy gig that people would have loved to have had.
Right.
And it was allowing me to have a, like, quote, great life.
Right.
But I wasn't happy at all. And then, you know, this coach got me to really see how I could create a culture of a company, an organization where people wore jeans and t-shirts, where we built communities where you could do yoga and meditate. And,
you know,
we would go on meetings that we would run together instead of sitting in a conference room. We could run. And I mean, that was my coffee shop, my motorcycle.
Yeah.
And when I got that, I was on fire, excited. And so all the noise around, you know, friends and security and kids and all that just like went away. I just said, I got to go.
Can I just tell you something? Yeah. So going way back to the whole you submitting your thing to the author.
Yeah.
If that's what she heard, that's high concept. If that's what she heard, right?
Yeah.
Oh, this guy who built this thing wanted to do it differently. And he started, like, it's basically a kind of your example of kind of like also what I did, you know, doing meetings while you're running, jeans and t-shirt. He established a culture and changed the temperature of the room. And also he did these things and built a conscious community. Dude, there's an amazing hook and story. So you gave her something that was not that. And I know at the time you said you were just building, but anyway.
Yeah. Well, it's good to hear. I hope you're right. You know, I would love to.
I mean, I hope it's in your book.
It is. Yeah. It all is.
Yeah.
It is. And, you know, hopefully, you know, somebody sees that. But yeah, I just think, you know, this idea of kind of, you know, living in the solid self, living authentically, not letting the noise kind of keep you, you know, as we've, you know, been talking about, just keep coming back to those little flashes of insight, that ping, that feeling, that, you know, trusting it seems to really be the way through.
Yeah. And I think the trick, I don't know if the word's trick, I think the goal is you got to keep giving yourself new experiences. So I think a lot of people see it, they want it, they're very logical, left brain, think about it, but they don't give their body the experience. And so what happens is the false belief still lives inside them, even though logically they're like, here's what I need to do. Here, you know, you almost have to give your body the experience where you're programming, not your logic, but your body. Oh, I just sold a book. Mm-hmm. Wait, maybe I'm not a failed writer. Because I could think that. I could do affirmations. I could go to, you know, I could walk on fire. I could whatever, go to seminars and shit. It wasn't until I held Miserable Fuck in my arms at the airport. The airport picked it up, and it's really hard to get your book at the airport because mm-hmm. there's, you know, seven books there. But it was walking at it in an airport, seeing it, and like actually this body, so dropping into my body, like holding it and thinking, this is my book. I wrote this. My story here is at the airport. I'm holding it physically in my hand. So it wasn't a lot. So if I imagined it, that'd be very different than actually experiencing it. And then I was like, okay, I wonder what else is possible. Maybe I was wrong about myself. So all those things came after the experience of it, not thinking or not, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
So I think there's nothing more convincing than a new experience. And so like rungs of a ladder, you got to keep giving yourself new experiences. And it doesn't have to be like that. It could be something like, you know, today, oh, we talk about ice. It could be something like, okay, today the new experience I'm going to give myself is I'm going to go into the ice for 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. And while I'm doing it, I'm going to be calm or whatever. So you're feeling it in your body, you know? Maybe for you, it's walking into the buildings that you've created, or maybe it's, you know, doing things like this where you're like taking a moment. You're like, you know, John and I were talking about me doing stuff like this many years ago. And here I am actually talking to him and doing it. And I feel it, you know, rewiring your body, I think is where there's a lot of power there.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's funny. I've had the airport thought and imagine, you know, that what that would be like, you know, I find dreaming sort of vision, you know, like seeing something. What's happened here, like a friend and I kind of like envisioned, and then, you know, I kind of forgot about it. And then I just went to work. And then like one day, you know, years later, even just like you said, like being here with you right now, you know, something that maybe I had like a dream of, you know, that I would be doing, it was loose, you know, in this world kind of thing, right? And then you just like, you go to work and you do, you know, a couple hundred episodes, and then like, boom, it comes. And so there's something to that. I think, you know, when you string together these solid self moments over a long period of time, really like anything's possible.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You know, the big thing that I'm trying to get to today as a 50-year-old is the question that I ask myself is, what if this is it? Because I spent my whole life chasing. Mm-hmm. I spent my whole life. Okay, now that I'm here, I just need to get there. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people do this with, especially on social media. Now that I have, you know, X amount of followers, I just now got to get to, you know, the million, right? Yeah. Get to, you know, 10,000, whatever that number is. And I think it flips the magnet. I think it then gets us to chase instead of attract. And I've been doing that my entire life, right? And so it's very knee-jerk. It's my default is to want more, bigger, shinier.
Mm.
And with 50 comes a lot of, like I said, surrender. And so now the big question is, what if this is it, John? What if, you know, six books, one being a workbook, one child, a Harley, my little getaway house in Idlewild. What if you just run a retreat once a month and you write your book, you do your podcast, you're in your garage talking. And what if this is it? Like, what if there's nothing that's going to be bigger? Would you be happy? Is this enough? Can you still be passionate? Can you still be fired up about conversations and having guests and like just doing what you do, playing with your phone? I think if I could get to a place where I am, there's so much peace there. I think if you could genuinely get to a place where you're like, it's not that you don't want more, but I am very happy with this, my little world.
Yeah.
I think that's when it comes. You know,
right. Then
that's when the phone starts ringing.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. It's kind of letting go of the chase.
Yes. It's also like in dating, when you don't feel like you're interested is when they want to hang out with you.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, I was actually going to ask you, you know, because so much of what you do now is on the relationship side.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking a lot about kind of business and work, but you know, you do a lot of work on the relationship side, and you know, your divorce is part of what really sparked all of this. And you mentioned last night somebody had asked you a question and you were talking about how like it's not all, I forget the language you use, but like rainbows and unicorns, like life, right, is moments of joy. Right. That you put together.
It's not constant. Like happy's not constant. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, talk to me a little bit about kind of the relationship side of it, when you talk about peace and embracing it for what it is and not chasing on that side, wanting more all the time.
Yeah, I think in my 20s, so as a 50-year-old, when it comes to love and relationship, the two words that kind of glow like neon has been lately possession and permission. And what I mean by that is in my 20s, I was very possessive, like a lot of men controlling, a very grabby, objectifying. And I saw love as, if you go down, I'm going down with you. And if I go down, you're going down with me, you know? And I think part of it was cultural, like growing up in a Korean family, there was no your money, our money. It was like our money in the pot. What does Brett need? Oh, he wants a Mazda? Okay, it'll go to him. You know, like it was just all about the family. We live and die together. And I thought that was romantic. And then in my 30s, I realized that's enmeshment and codependency, and it's suffocation, and it's me grabbing someone's leg because of my childhood wounds, because of my mother-father wounds, because of my obsession, addiction, whatever, right? And then my 40s was like, okay, when, what does healthy look like? Oh, we need our own lives. It's not two people in a jacuzzi sitting on top of each other, which is very sexy. It's actually two people in separate bathtubs looking in the same direction and maybe connected by holding hands, right? And now my 50s, what would love look like if there wasn't possession? What would love look like if there was more permission? One of the things that I'm working on with my partner is like actually asking her, hey, do you mind if I hold you like this? Do you mind? Can I kiss you here? And it's weird because, you know, I grew up like everyone else, every other boy in locker rooms where, you know, you walk through the kitchen, slap her ass and you grab her and you're aggressive and that kind of stuff. And what she's getting from it is, because she's also lived in this world, she's like, wow, when you do that, I feel so safe and so loved. Then she also does it back, you know, it's not like a gender thing. And we're playing with that. And it's making us realize like that we've just been conditioned to see love a certain way. And if we start to deprogram ourselves, love can, I mean, everyone's customizing love now, you know, the blueprint of the picket fence and the, you know, the 2.2 kids, man, that shit's, I mean, we know because our parents were sleeping in separate rooms, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think till the day that I die, I'm always going to be learning about love. And I think love is formless. And I think as I change and as Vanessa changes, our love and how we love and what we want love to look like is going to change, you know, as opposed to back in the day, maybe in the 50s, this is what love looked like. Mm-hmm. This is what you should do. This is what you should wear. This is how a husband acts or a wife acts. There's a lot of rocks being turned over these days, which is exciting, but also very activating for a lot of people. And it's stirring up a lot of stuff. Mm. Yeah. So, I mean, with love, I don't have answers. I'm curious and I'm kind of going back to being a student to love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I appreciate the way that you frame that because it's probably the most honest thing, you know, anybody could say is that they don't have answers.
Yeah. And with love, we want answers.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because we need promise. The other word is promise. It's like permission, possession, and promise. Those three P's. I got married putting everything on the promise. And I realized, I don't think we should.
Yeah. I'm not sure this is what you're saying, but I think there's a little, I'm going to sound old here, but like, I think there's something happening, which is cuts both ways, not just in relationships, but in like work and life where people aren't committing.
Yeah.
In the way that they used to, right? And like commitment could be a bad thing in that like nobody says you should be unhappy forever, right? Or in a marriage that, you know, is loveless and you're doing it because, you know, anything else is a failure, right? Or a career where, you know, you work an unhappy job forever.
Right.
But, you know, shit gets tough. People change.
People change.
The life is hard sometimes, right? Yeah. Like, isn't that just sort of part of the gig too? Like we have to kind of like be with that part too to get to the good stuff. Sometimes you got to go through some shit, right?
Yeah. And I mean, think about what you like or across the board, whether it's food, love, you know, today, or even how you think as opposed to when you were 20, it's so different, right? And so if that's the constant, which is change, how can you expect love to be, you know, in this box but you're changing. Mm-hmm. I think as we change, yes, and of course, life turbulence, circumstances change, what we want for ourselves should change. Yeah. You know, that's the other permission piece, is giving ourselves permission to say, hey, this is what I want. This is my truth. I never knew I wanted this, mm-hmm. but this is where I'm at. This is what I would like.
Yeah.
And that could be a Harley, or that could be non-monogamy, or that could be marriage, or it can be something that has been passed down from generations, as long as it's your truth.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
It could be, yeah, I want to be with you forever and that's okay.
Yeah.
Or it could be, I want to live in a commune.
Right.
Who knows?
Right. You know? Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's permission for it to want it, to try it, and for it to not work or not be the answer.
Yeah. Probably.
You know?
I mean, the thing is not about it working or not. The thing is, what are you learning from this journey and exploration? It's like, you know, I love Bourdain.
Yeah.
Because I just love that he kind of saw the world through curiosity.
Mm.
And I never saw him as like a food guy, even though that's what he did. I saw him as kind of a pioneer and exploration. So culture, people, connection, like he just did it through the lens of food.
Yeah.
And his amazing voiceovers. And I just feel like that's more of the mindset today with the next generation, is curiosity, exploration. What else is there? Not like I'm going to trace this thing that I learned in school.
Yeah.
Or what my parents did.
Yeah, Bourdain's another one that, you know, I've kind of gone down the rabbit hole with, because I also, energetically, there's something. I mean, this is why he was so.
He just seems also like a normal dude.
Yeah, but he was also like a fucking badass.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
you know, it's the same sort of, you know, skateboard
addiction. Yeah, addiction is one,
right?
Obsessive. Yeah.
Right. And it's interesting because, you know, I was recently reading something where he was talking about, like, in his final text messages to his girlfriend, you know, he was talking about how he hated being famous.
Yeah.
He just hated it.
Yeah.
He just didn't want to live like that. And it was like, I can't remember exactly, but I think it was like in one of his final messages, text messages, you know, and it feels like there was so much pain under that too.
Yeah.
Right. That a lot of the antics, a lot of the self-expression, a lot of the...
Robin Williams. Another
one, yeah. Right? That underneath it, there was just so much pain.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know what that's about. Is it about like being content and at peace, or, you know, okay without the likes and the clicks and the, you know?
I think it's deeper than that. I think we also have demons.
Yeah.
I think we all have demons.
Yeah. Know?
And a lot of times we're not able to make peace with our story or things that have happened or whatever. And I think that manifests. I think a lot of people who become successful create their own island. I think success can also be very lonely, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I don't know what was going on in his personal life, but I'm sure he felt, I think as he got more successful, he felt more lonely, more secluded, more hopeless, like all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about something a little bit more positive, just to wrap up.
And a positive note.
I mean, I know you mentioned last night you've been doing some retreats, and I know, you know, that's how you got to know Brandon. And kind of curious about, you know, what's on your radar these days? Like, what, you know, are the solid self, you know, John Kim's that you're really leaning into, feeling passionate about, want to share with our audience?
Hollywood has knocked on my door a few times in the last 5 years, and it brings up a lot in me because, you know, my whole screenwriting part of my life. So it feels like Hollywood keeps playing ding dong ditch. They'll knock and then I answer the door. No one's there, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like getting a call from someone you had a crush on, and she's just like, hey, like, why are you calling me? Mm-hmm. You know, but one of my books got optioned. And so there's been some TV stuff that has kind of happened and not happened. And then with Hollywood, it's feast or famine. So as fast as something gets set up, it can also die.
Mm-hmm.
So I've sat with that and I've realized that although I have been pulling a lot from my solid self, I still have a pseudo tug, and it's become kryptonite for me, you know? But I would like to pursue something on that platform just because it's new to me. So speaking of Bourdain, television, documentary, presenting self-help in a way that we haven't seen before on the television platform. So I'm trying to manifest and think about and feed that. I will continue to write books as long as people are buying them. My little retreats I do on the week, once a month, have become very kind of sacred church, kind of really cool just a weekend, 12 people. I would love for you to come.
Yeah, I will.
And it's bare bones, man.
Yeah.
I mean, I do have a chef. The food's amazing, but it's not like massage. I mean, it's literally 12 people in the living room, amazing food, ice bath, in, you know, a fucking trough, mm-hmm. breath work, processing, and just bare bones.
Yeah.
Which is kind of my style.
Cool.
So just doing more of that. And then, you know, I love podcasting. I always say I channel Christian Slater and Pump Up the Volume. Yeah.
I was just listening to you talk about that. Our generation.
Very hard on.
Yeah. Yeah. I freaking love that
movie. Yeah. And I don't think it did well. I think it was.
Kind of, I heard you say that. And it was funny because I'm like, really? Because I thought it was like the greatest thing that ever happened.
But did it commercially? I don't think so. Because he's not known for that movie.
No.
It's under the radar. But how relatable a kid who in school is kind of awkward and introverted. And then he finds his cape at home in the basement of his parents. It's like, you know, it's really cool, man. But that's how I see myself in my garage. Mm-hmm. It's just the microphone talking about my feelings. Mm-hmm. So I enjoy doing that.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's part of the reason why, you know, the traditional format of this podcast is to kind of connect these dots all the way to the work that you're doing so that people can see themselves in your journey, comfort in it. Yeah. You know, a lot of times people just look at the end and they go, well, John's got all these followers and he's written all these books and there's no way I could ever do that. Yeah. But the truth is that it's, you know, it's possible and it requires, you know, step by step by step until. But what I love about it is in the end, and this is kind of the thing that I'm really, you know, trying to get clear in my book, is that it's all, the dots do all connect. Mm-hmm. And that like your younger self, the screenwriter, you know, that was trying to, you know, get rich and famous in Hollywood and be all the things with the cars and the fame.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that the platform's wrong. You know, like you could still create in the world of film, in the world of television, in the world of writing from your now.
Yeah, instead of then.
Right. Solid. Stuff, right. And so it's like, wouldn't it be even better that you now come to that work from this place, right? And still, you know, end up coming back to the thing. And it's not about the money and the fame, but it's about that medium that spoke to you.
Yeah, I don't see myself writing high concept alien movies or things that I was trying to sell before.
Sure.
If I do play in that world, it would definitely be based on me as a therapist
in my
current life, for sure. Or else it wouldn't be honest.
Yeah.
It would be fake, right?
Yeah.
I think it was Steve Jobs who says that you can only connect dots when you look back.
Yeah, right.
And so if something like that happened, that would be a dot connected. And the dot connected would be, yes, I was meant to play in that world, but not then.
Right.
I first had to get the divorce.
Yeah.
Buy the motorcycle. I had 20 years of my life, whatever, 15 years of my life going on this journey. You know, I needed to get my heart shattered. And I needed to drink coffee and styrofoam before I could pay $10 for pour over coffee. Now. Yeah. I needed to do that. And also a lot of Wayne Dyer.
Yeah.
And listening and walking alone, eating.
Yeah.
I needed to do all of that to position myself for then to come to that platform with something different and fresh and real.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to sell high concept, you know, action movies or whatever it was. That wasn't other people, but not me. That was my path.
Yeah. I think that's what makes it solid. That's what makes it real. That's what makes it relatable, authentic,
Is
that it's like got substance to it. It's not some, you know, Hollywood funny bullshit that isn't going to last either.
Yeah. And if it doesn't happen, that's okay. Then there's not to be connected elsewhere.
Yeah, right.
You know, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming here, for, you know, being a part of both the Gravity community, the podcast, and just for being a friend and being in my life.
Yeah.
I really love knowing you, spending time with you.
Yeah, I appreciate you. And I also love that we're around the same age. I connect. There's a kinship.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
And we're not hanging out every day, but just to know that we're kind of on the same journey in different ways is it makes me feel less alone. It's great. Yeah. I love it.
Cool.
Thank you.
Yeah. Awesome.
All right.
Thanks, Sean.
Be well.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to the Gravity Podcast. Please subscribe to the show at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. To learn more about the entire Gravity Project, please go to gravityproject.com. Please check out the podcast on Instagram @thegravitypodcast.
Music heard in the show is provided courtesy of Kyle Lamoro and Oliver Oak.